The Guardian. Each month this year, intrepid members of the Guardian Books team have trekked to the top of the Queen Elizabeth Hall on London's South Bank to visit a writer coming to the end of 4 days interned on a boat modelled on the one in Joseph Conrad's novella, The Heart of Darkness. It's now December and we're back to welcome the final inhabitant as he quits his home of the last 4 days. He's Colm Toybean, Irish writer and essayist whose Costa Prize-winning Brooklyn is shortly to be filmed and whose latest short book, The Testament of Mary, takes a rather unseasonal look at a very seasonal story through the eyes of one of its most celebrated characters. Colm, we're actually inside the boat now. It's beautifully sunny outside. I don't know why we started outside.
It's a wonderful morning. It's been like this since about 5.30 or 6. You know, this is the logbook, so the light wakes you. I mean, I don't use the blinds, so I mean, I did a little drawing of myself. I'm such a bad illustrator. But this is Friday morning. Well, this is Thursday night. It's strange listening to Radio 3 and watching London. No wind, rain from the west, but no other rain. Looked at a star. And then work at 5.30.
5.30 in the morning, that
is. Yes, had no peculiar... had not pulled blinds. Slowly a beautiful, ponderous winter morning unfolds over the river. Radio 3, then Radio 4, then Radio 3. Then, visitors came in. And because in the story I was using something to do with the river and I don't know anything about boats, luckily Robert Collingwood, who came, he told me where you would tie up a boat in my story and about the changing of tides and what that 10 minutes looks like when the tides change.
So everybody else has written essays and you have made a rather bold break by writing a short story.
Yes, couldn't think of anything to say in an essay, whereas I woke up on Friday morning. I mean, I didn't put it in here, and I, with the phrase, I showed you written here, where somebody asks somebody else, I think it opens life or death. I don't know, just what a funny idea that you would start a story with that, with the phrase life or death. But then Ruth Padell came and she gave me a word for the story, replete. She said, I need to put that into the story.
So you've had a party, it looks like. This is a logbook.
What I did was I invited anyone who had children to come around on Saturday. So you can see that Nell O'Hagan came, and you can see that Charlie Stroud, Olivia Stroud came.
So lots of butterflies and birds.
And the Strauss family, Toby Strauss and Willa and their friend Lucy came. And then this was when it all got serious. I mean, where loads of people came on Saturday night, and Peter Liversidge came, and Lorcan O'Neill, and Ruth Padell came again, and God only knows who that signature is by. And then Nadia Maslam came on Sunday with Pankhurst Mishra and Mary Mount, and Maya Mishra did a drawing. She's also young. And then this was the end of last night, where a few people came and we had a bit of bubbles. And then story finished, 4,500 words.
And so tell us what the story, you've given us a few keywords.
I suppose I was trying to imagine Marlowe in Heart of Darkness talking, and the idea, as the others listened, that he wasn't telling the truth, that in fact, I mean, I don't call him Marlowe, he's the old man, he's older now, and he's telling a story, but it may be that he, in fact, himself was much more implicated in what happened than Kurtz, and he's just trying to see what the story would sound like if he gave all the guilt to somebody else. That's all I'm trying to do.
And you began and ended it on the boat. Did you think about it? The whole idea came to you on the boat.
Yes, I had no idea when I came on the boat what I was going to do, so I couldn't think of an essay. When I was going to talk about the size of the river or rivers, and that is what an awful business. You know, some writer generalizing about rivers, and then I just got an opening, and once I got the opening, I was away. And I normally work in longhand, but I realised I wouldn't have time if I worked in longhand to do the longhand and then onto the laptop. So I just wrote straight onto the laptop. And even between guests, I would, you know, someone would go on Saturday and I would have an hour and I would go back up there upstairs and I would work for an hour solid. And so it came almost of its own accord. Once I had the opening, it came. And I spent a lot of Sunday reading it over. I have to say there was more nonsense in it than usual. I mean, there were two last paragraphs in which there were some of the sentences were so bad, some of the images were so atrociously pretentious. Luckily, all that has been removed.
And when you say up there, you mean up this rather treacherous metal stepladder.
Yes, if you go up the treacherous metal stepladder, then in the floor above, it's a tiny room, but you can close the hatch and there's a desk. You can pull the desk across and you're even higher up in your room for London than you are down here. Here is sort of domestic space. It's sort of kitcheny and it's a bedroom. But up there, it's more pure. So I did a lot of work up there.
And you actually went right up on the sun deck and up into the mast for a final photo call.
Well, I would go up. I went up there all the time because I was the only person who really knew how to do it. And everybody, of course, who came to visit wanted to go up there. So I thought, well, I'll have to bring them all up. And because you couldn't stay up there for long because it's December and there's wind and stuff. But it's wonderful up there. The strange thing is that I was hoping that someone walking across the bridge, because we're quite close to Waterloo Bridge, would notice and stand, but nobody did. Nobody once, and there were crowds here yesterday and Sunday down below, looked up. So that I think you can see the boat much easier from the other side of the river, but nobody looked up because I was looking down to see if I could catch someone's eye and wave or something.
You said memorably, this is the place where nobody could hear you scream, but it's also the place where nobody can see you laugh.
Yeah, I mean, you're too far away from anything. And some of it's very pure. I mean, it's a very pure idea over the water, over the city, St. Paul's down there, Big Ben up there. But yesterday, or maybe it was Saturday, wafting up from all the stalls that are below at the South Bank and people walking up and down came Fairy Tale of New York, you scumbag, you maggot, someone, you know, so that the real world won't go away. The real world wafts up.
So tell us the title of your story.
It's called A Boat.
And now let's hear A Boat.
Life and death, Williamson asked. Do you mean both? Yes, the old man replied quietly, moving his two fingers towards his lips. He inhaled with satisfaction, filling his lungs as though he was still a smoker. It was one of his habits. He thought for a moment, yes, both. And they believed they were the same thing. No, like all of us, they understood the difference perfectly. I mean, how could you not? But then surely, yes, I suppose it might seem odd. You know, I never discussed it with anyone during my two sojourns on the island, and my other stay on the neighbouring one. It was somehow not open for discussion. Not much was open for discussion, which made time there very agreeable. That is, before the attack. I think the attack destroyed everything. Well, I'm sure it did. Williamson had come to enjoy his wealth, or the wealth his wife possessed. He'd married late, and had, we knew, taken his time to adjust to his new domestic circumstances. His wife was a great talker. He liked to say that he bought the boat to get away from her chatter, but I believe in fact that she bought it for him because she needed time away from his silence. It had been a perfect day's sailing, and the crew of two had gone to get some spare part for the boat. It left us alone in the dwindling light as the tide began to turn on the great river, and we waited for Williamson's driver to come and collect us. We had tied up at Deptford at the usual place, close to the small culvert, having come in an hour earlier than expected. All three of us watched the stillness in the water, as though the water's breath were being held. We stood looking as the boats around us slackened on their ropes and then slowly turned. As usual, it was relaxed and easy between the three of us, between Williamson and myself, who had shared lodgings in Hong Kong after the war, and the old man who had sailed for many years in the South China Sea and had come home from air haulage had taken over many of the old trade routes, when policing some of the ports in the East had become more efficient. Things were more relaxed between us indeed since the death of Henry Bacon, who had come with us on these excursions before his illness. H. Bacon, as he was known, usually enjoyed an argument and was sure to contradict any remark made once the humour took him. He had now taken his opinions, many of them tedious, to the grave. We did not replace Bacon, and this meant there was an added peace between us which came from his absence. The lovely idea that we were, all three of us, too old now for novelty seemed to give us satisfaction. The old man had roamed that part of the world uneasily.
When he made money, he did not, as others did, settle down, keep a wife and family in Kent or Sussex, while he sailed out once more to support them. He spent what he made on disappearing. There was much talk about him, as he was often left ashore alone and unarmed on islands which no Englishman had yet set foot, or islands on which no Englishman or Dutchman, indeed, had stayed for very long. And then he would be found 6 months later rounding up a crew to take some goods, tobacco often, but also, I believe, contraband from one port to another. He knew the reefs and the remote islands, it was said, as no one else in those years. And it was agreed among those I knew, even as late as the 50s, that if anyone went in search of him, or if anyone sought to intercept him, they would not find him. He was perhaps the last of a kind. They believed in nothing except boats, he went on. The sun, or the night, or the sea itself didn't seem to interest them. And they had no artifacts or icons, which was rather a relief. And they did not paint the boats or decorate them. Wood, of course, was scarce, and that made the boats important. They traded what they produced for planks or dead trees. They produced fruit, of course, too much of the bloody stuff. But the main thing they produced that could be traded was called palimene, which was a sort of berry. If you rubbed it thoroughly on meat or fish, or indeed a dead body, it would preserve it for months and maybe more. You did not need salt. It was unique to the island and in great demand by the other islands. It gave things a delicious flavour. It was like lemon, but darker and richer. I always thought I could have made a fortune had I cleared the place of most of its inhabitants and cultivated the stuff. I think it was all destroyed with the fire, so we won't have that to fall back on when the refrigerator fails us. He said the word refrigerator with immense distaste, but it was the word fire that I noticed, the casual way he said it. And the boats? Williamson asked. What I understood was that they took the view that a boat, once made, had powers. He seemed to feel that he had said all he needed to say on the matter of boats. He stood up and stretched and then checked for a moment in the direction of the road, as though he were impatient to get away. So they worshipped boats? Williamson asked. The old man did not reply. If he were lost in thought, then the thought seemed to be about some other matter. A sound came, like a car approaching. It did not come closer, and then it faded. I found myself shivering. It was something about the silence, but it also had to do with the breaking of silence. We had all seen things, or felt them. I had been interned by the Japanese in the war, and I had marks to show for it. Williamson, too, had his wounds, but they came from before, from his father, who was a great brute. But I knew about this only because of the nightmares he had in those years when we lodged together. He had never willingly spoken of them, as I had never spoken of being tortured. I never indeed been asked by these two men to explain the burn mark across my back and the opening in my stomach the size of a grapefruit, or the strange catch in my voice. The old man was not a salty dog who told stories. Like us, he had met those types and found them tedious. What made me shiver now was that I found that his need to explain this business of the boats was unlikely, unworthy of him. It was all the more irritating because it came from a need that seemed to have been there all along, something merely suppressed or held in check until now. He was giving in to it, and I disliked being in his garrulous presence while it happened. I had presumed until then that the friendship between us three and H. Bacon was based most firmly on the idea we disliked stories and storytellers and tales of islands and the time before the war or the war itself. All of us, I understood, had much to be silent about. As the clouds became darker and a small wind seemed to blow up, I shivered again. I noticed Williamson watching me, uneasy too, or bored or sad. They embalmed the dead and kept them close by, and then, when the time came and the tides were right, the old man went on, they released them, sent them out by boat, to wherever. Not to return, in any case. They seemed to have no problem but losing the boats. What was strange, also, was how at certain times the islanders kept away from their boats, left them on the beach. No one even went near the beaches then. And later, When the moon was almost full, they would approach and pray. At least it sounded like prayer. If there were births, they happened in secret. But on these nights, they were revealed. The women came with babies towards the boats and put them in one of them. And then they pushed that boat out with other boats to guide it. And they did a circle of the island, all the time safely guiding the unmanned boat with the babies inside. It was done in silence. He stopped again. I wondered what this might have been like had H. Bacon been here, at what point he would have interrupted and stopped this. The sky was darkening now, and there was a band of flaming red over the city to the west. I felt free to study it as it faded and sank and gave way to a band of yellow light, and then dark clouds made all the darker by the edge of faded light around them. Sometimes planks from the boats sent out would be washed up, the old man eventually continued, and that was how they knew that the dead had not found rest. And there would be many days of further silence on the island. I do not know what resting place they had in mind for their dead, but I do know that not to arrive there was to live forever in some dark state. No single body was ever washed up on the beaches, by the way. That would have been unthinkable somehow. Maybe the Palimene caused bodies to sink in water. He spoke as though his story had just begun and would conclude far away from this version of island belief or magic or whatever it was. When I turned, I found Williamson with his hands covering his face. It struck me then for a moment that there had been a story I had heard years before that implicated the old man in something. I'd heard it in Macau from an Irishman who was drunk. I noted the name of the old man, whom I knew at that time by sight and reputation. In those years there were always stories, especially about those who came and went, and seemed to have knowledge of the inlets and the islands. Also in those years, when my wife had left me, I drank and often craved company late at night. I heard more stories then than I cared to hear. I heard many of them twice or three times. But many of them, too, were only half told, as this one I heard from the Irishman about the old man was. But I remembered it, or most of it. It made sense that someone who moved as the old man did in the years before the war had such stories told about him. It also seemed reasonable that the story, such as it was, might even be true. I knew the Englishman Fleming, the old man went on. He made his money in arms, which was more dangerous than opium and more lucrative. Once I had covered for him, and he was grateful for that, but knew not to show his gratitude in any public way. He paid me, but knew not to greet me, no matter where he met me. He now arrived on the island with two Malay servants. There were rumours about him and his taste in servants, but that is another matter. They almost saved his life, the two of them. There is that to be said. But in doing so, of course, or failing to do so, they caused even more trouble than Fleming caused. I wish I could say that Fleming meant no harm. There was no evidence that he did mean harm, but I had never known this to be the case before, so I must presume that he had a plan, a reason to set up temporary house on the island, to oversee the two servants and a few others, build him a dwelling from sand and bamboo. Perhaps, like me, he understood the value of Palimene if it could be planted commercially. But I do not think he had a great interest in rare plants. Perhaps he was hiding from someone. He must have done quite a bit of hiding, especially in the years when he armed some Chinese rebels and some Muslim groups in Malaysia, who needed to defend themselves. In any case, he slept on his boat with his rifle close to him and some loaded pistols while the building was going on. I would have left had there been a way to leave, and it would have helped him, of course, had he spoken to me. When we met one day, he smiled in a way which was knowing and wicked and sly, and then he passed on without speaking, followed by his two servants, who looked sullen when they caught sight of me. Since it was some months since I had seen someone from home, I could have done with a few words with anyone at all, even Fleming. But I did not look back at him or his two servants. I imagine he did not look back either. One of them, by the way, was quite remarkable looking. I mean striking. I could have told Fleming, had he asked, that he must not use the planks that were washed up on the beach for any purpose, and that he should keep away from the beach when there were boats there. But in those first weeks there were no boats on the beach. The ones the island owned had been used just before Fleming's arrival to ferry the dead away. The islanders watched for planks that might be washed up. They watched in case a sign came that some of their dead had not made it to their destination. And when some planks drifted in with the waves, they moved into their ritual of silence. Even the children knew to be silent, and the babies too, for all I know. I found out the planks were missing from where they had lain, on the beach, the same morning it was noticed by the islanders. I wondered later if they came to me first to make sure that I did not have them. When they saw that I indeed was not in possession of them, they went to find Fleming. He was there, overseeing his new place of shelter. He was armed. He had his rifle and his pistols, and he had the planks. When they demanded he hand them over, he refused. When they insisted in very strong terms, he shot two of them. I heard the shots, and I knew to stay where I was. I would have to make clear as best I could that this had nothing to do with me. Fleming and his two servants made it back to their boat after the shooting, by swimming, or so I understand. Fleming would not have been a great swimmer. He was a fat, ungainly man, and I don't think he took naturally to water. By the time he and his two Malays were trying to get the engine started, a number of the islanders had swum underwater and were already under the boat. And they appeared on deck, indeed, before they had even been seen in the water. They wanted only Fleming. They took him off the boat in a great burst of yelping and calling on his part. They ducked him well in salt water as they dragged him back to the island. He was on shore again before he knew where he was. The servants, once they had the engine working, moved the boat away. No one tried to stop them, which, in retrospect, of course, was a mistake. In fact, it was to prove the undoing of the whole island. They were rather proud of what they did with Fleming. They invited me to come and see it several times. It involved a breed of ants that they must have kept especially for such an eventuality, and some sugary substance, almost hard like glue, that they wound around Fleming, whom they stripped naked for this purpose. They tied his hands behind his back and left him sitting. They even fed him and gave him water over the days that followed, as the ants slowly went for the sugar, and then the skin and the organs, and wherever else was there. Whatever pain Fleming felt at first was nothing to what came later, that must be said. The ants were tiny little things, and they took their time. They seemed to have a sting, but not at first. I wondered if the sting was provoked by the sound of a man screaming. It was 4 or 5 days before the work was finished. By this time, a small ship had appeared on the horizon, accompanied by Fleming's boat. What was extraordinary was that the islanders seemed not to be worried about this. They had never been shot before, as far as I could make out, or had planks stolen. And they associated all this with Fleming, and Fleming alone, as though he were some sort of solitary demon wandering the earth, pink and fat and pleased with himself, and he'd now been put paid to. So they let the boat and the small ship come close, and they seemed pleased when a rowing boat was lowered from the ship, and a number of armed men appeared. Two of them were Dutch, and there were a few others I could not easily place. One of them spoke English, and another seemed to be able to make himself understood in the islanders' language. The islanders took these newcomers to see what was left of Fleming, as we might take visitors to the Lake District or the British Museum. A mixture of mild duty and pride of some sort, but more a feeling, it seemed, that not to have shown the visitors Fleming's whitened bones might have deprived them of one of the sights. It did not occur to the islanders who did the showing, as far as I could make out, that the wider world did not share their own particular reverences. I imagine people take the same view of the Church of England or the Roman Church, and suppose that these religions are known about worldwide, and the truth of their doctrines is somehow self-evident. I imagine that too, Williamson said dryly. It was now dark, and I felt a cold coming from the water the beginnings of a night breeze. I could not see the old man, but I could get a sense of Williamson close to me. I could hear his breathing and feel that he was listening with care now to what was being said. In all the years, not one of us had ever spoken like this. We had confined our speech to comments on the wind and the tide, and perhaps the temperature. In all the years, too, Williamson's driver would have been here early and would have been waiting for us. And also, if the crew went somewhere, they normally came back soon. In all the years as well, H. Bacon would have interrupted any one of us who spoke at all, forced us to change the subject, or more usually, forced us to say nothing more. When Fleming's supporters found me, the old man continued as though he had not been interrupted, they gave me a choice. I could stay on the island or leave it. If I left, it was agreed that they would drop me quietly on a neighbouring island some distance away. They would never say they had seen me. The idea that I would do the same for them did not need to be mentioned. I know they had some kind of retribution in mind, but I don't think they were sure what form it might best take. It helped their resolve, I think, that they were shown the ants by the islanders later that day. The ants were happy little fellows, replete after their feast, being held in case they were to be needed again. The ants helped steal their resolve, or so they told me. Once they managed to ascertain in full how Fleming had met his end, how long it had taken, and how generally noisy it had been, they made up their minds. The islanders were rather anxious to share all the information about Fleming's demise. It was, after all, a matter of pride with them, and they seemed to feel that the visitors would share their pride, or be glad at least that it had happened. The visitors, of course, were careful to show no emotion one way or the other. They were armed, and that might have helped. The islanders were not skilled at reading emotion. I think they thought the visitors were going to depart soon, having supped with them, or that they might stay a while longer and enjoy the large and abundant supply of fruit, and maybe come to visit the two shot men, embalmed perfectly now by the Palimene. The dead in many homes on the island were given the best, or at least the most prominent place to sleep, and were propped up outside during the day, as if to enjoy better the sunshine and the scenery. It is hard to remember at what point it was decided to burn the island. The old man continued and then stopped. He had made it sound for that one second as though he were involved in that decision. In the silence that followed, I felt someone grip my upper arm, and I knew it was Williamson. Williamson, who was always a great listener, must have, I imagined, heard the story too about the old man that I heard from the drunken Irishman in Macau. He had known, I surmised, the story of the fire before the old man came to it. I should have always presumed that he had known this story. "What were you doing on the island?" I suddenly asked the old man. "What do you mean?" he asked. "I mean, in the first place, what were you doing there? What were you doing on the island in the first place?" "There were always reasons," he said in a whisper. He made that simple sentence sound like a threat. But it was more than a threat. He had, for a few seconds, lost his ease, his composure, his contentment at being with friends on a boat after a good day. I reached over and touched Williamson's shoulder. "What happened?" Williamson asked. And when the old man did not answer, he asked the question again. "What happened?" "They had made up their minds what to do," the old man said firmly, coldly. "They planned it carefully and deliberately, and they moved fast. They had combustibles on board, which they placed in the rowing boat and then got them onto the island. They knew what to do, what plan to follow. They knew to go right round the island and then start the fire so it would spread. It was easy once it began. By the time we were moving away, it was a conflagration. I expected to hear shouts, but I heard nothing. I expected to see figures running from the flames into the water, but no one appeared on the beach. You see, whoever they were, these people, they accepted death. I had not known that about them, or perhaps I had, but had not seen it put to the test. I suppose I knew very little about them in the end, whoever they were. After the war, when the British were making more accurate maps of those islands, they went there, their cartographers, and found nothing. You know, I was consulted as one of the few who had known the islands before the war. But of course, I had no interest in going back. It was surprising, however, to be told that the cartographers and their helpers found nothing at all. No sign of anything. No Palimene, obviously, but nothing else either. No water table. No evidence that there ever had been fresh water on the island. It was abundant during my stay. I suppose they did not look carefully enough. And of course, no boats or any trace of boats. And that was that, then? Williamson asked. Yes, the old man said. Yes, he repeated with even greater certainty. That was that. Williamson moved as the sound of a car came and the headlight beamed across the mast of the boat. It was the crew. Soon a second car came, the sound of the engine like a soft purr. It was Williamson's. His driver beeped the horn once, as he usually did, to let us know he was waiting. As the other two made their way up the steps to the car, I stayed behind. I thought they could do without me for a few moments, as I stood to look at the lights of London rising faintly over the west. I thought then of the outsides of the houses stretching from the city into the suburbs, the windows, some dark and some lit, the painted front doors, and inside people preparing for the night or having a meal or talking or reading or listening to the radio or watching television, some alone, some with others. My mind moved away from them into the unoccupied rooms above them and around them, rooms with no lights on and doors closed or ajar. And within them the smaller spaces, the cupboards, the presses, the dressing table drawers, all filled with things, but hidden away not to be opened until something was needed. I watched the lights flickering in the horizon beyond the river and pictured those walking on the streets or sitting in cars, people like ghosts of themselves, silent, wary, or people sitting opposite each other on the tube or the bus, catching each other's eyes for a second and then glancing away. I wondered about the old man and the years I had known him. It was as though knowing him had been nothing more than a distraction. I wondered if he needed us to know him more, if that had been part of his plan, if he had come to the boat that day with such a plan in his mind, or if it had all come of its own accord. I stood and waited until his voice came from above, the voice severe, beckoning, in control, telling me that the car was waiting and we would have to go.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.